Okay, imagine this scene. You're in the ED. A 3-year-old kid arrives, seizing, totally unresponsive. Fever's through the roof, 105 Fahrenheit, and the parents mention recent travel to a place where malaria is common. So, what's the absolute one lab you need, like right this second, and what intervention are you already prepping?
Yeah, that's intense, and it's a scenario that plays out way too often. The numbers are just staggering. Think about 2022 estimated 249 million malaria cases globally
Wow.
and 608,000 deaths. The really heartbreaking part, over 90% of those deaths were kids in sub-Saharan Africa.
It really puts it into perspective, doesn't it? Okay, welcome everyone to 88 Diagnoses. We're all about getting you well-informed fast. Today, it's a deep dive into severe malaria. Our whole mission here is to give you a super high-yield, totally ward-ready guide, diagnosis, immediate steps, all based on the latest evidence. We want you ready to act.
Exactly. We'll cover how to spot it fast, what treatments to jump on, and how to handle those really tricky complications that can pop up.
All right, let's get into it. Welcome to segment one, rapid rundown. Let's nail the basics and get you started right. You know, I still remember this one night, I think I was an intern. Patient comes in, kind of vague fever, altered mental status. And I was just tunnel vision on the usual sepsis stuff, right? Completely, almost blew past the travel history.
Oh, yeah. Easy to do early on.
Totally. It's a mistake you don't make twice, hopefully. Spotting severe malaria isn't just ticking boxes, it's like connecting those dots fast. So let's give you the shortcut I wish I'd had back then.
Absolutely. And the key thing to grasp is severe malaria isn't just, bad malaria. It's a distinct clinical syndrome. It means you've got Plasmodium falciparum parasites, although sometimes P. vivax or P. nalesi can do it too, pluck at least one specific sign of major organ dysfunction or complication.
And knowing that specific definition, that's non-negotiable. For your exams, for the wards, you have to know this. So to help you lock it in, we've got a mnemonic. Think SHARP, CHAP.
Right. SHARP, CHAP. Let's break it down. Each letter is a warning sign. S is for shock. Could be compensated. Think cool peripheries, cap refill maybe 3 seconds or more, or decompensated where the blood pressure is really low, like systolic under 70 in kids or 80 in adults, and clear signs of poor perfusion.
Okay, shock. Got it.
H is hyperparasitemia. This one's a bit nuanced. For travelers who aren't immune, a parasitemia over 5% counts. For everyone else, it's a higher bar, over 10%. It tells you about the sheer load of parasites.
Makes sense. Different thresholds.
A stands for acidosis, big sign of metabolic chaos. You're looking for a base deficit over 8 or bicarb under 15, maybe lactate over 5. Clinically, often that really fast, deep labored breathing gives it away.
Cusmal breathing, yeah.
R is renal impairment. Usually that means creatinine climbing above 3 milligrams per deciliter or blood urea nitrogen over, say, 20 millimoles per liter.
Right, kidneys are taking a hit.
And P is pulmonary edema. You might see it on X-ray. Or clinically, their oxygen sat drops below 92% on room air, breathing fast, maybe over 30 breaths a minute, sometimes with crackles or chest retractions.
Okay, that's the sharp part. Now for CHAPC is for consciousness impaired. We're talking a Glasgow Coma Scale, GCS, score under 11 in adults, or for kids, a Blantyre Coma Score under 3. Basically, they're not alert.
Critical find. H is hypoglycemia. That's blood glucose dropping below 40 milligrams per deciliter. Or 2.2 millimoles per liter. Super dangerous.
Very dangerous. Okay. A is for anemia, specifically severe malarial anemia. The numbers here depend on age. Under 12, hemoglobin 5 or less, or hematocrit 15% or less. Adults, hemoglobin 7 or less, or hematocrit 20% or less. And crucially, this is with a parasite count over 10,000 per microliter.
Right, the parasite count matters there too. And finally, P is for prostration. Just profound weakness. The patient literally cannot sit, stand, or walk without help. It's more than just feeling tired.
Got it. That really covers the core criteria in SHARP CHAP.
Yeah, it does. But don't forget, there are a few other serious signs too, like multiple convulsions, more than two seizures in 24 hours, or significant bleeding, or jaundice if the bilirubin's really high, say over 50 micromoles per liter, and the parasite count is over 100,000. All red flags for severe disease.
Okay, here's a really practical on-the-wards tip. If a patient shows up with any of these SHARP CHAP signs and those other red flags, you start empiric malaria treatment immediately. Don't wait. You investigate other causes at the same time, but you treat for malaria right away.
Absolutely. Which leads to a quick thinking challenge. Pause here. Patient comes in, fever, impaired consciousness from an endemic area. Besides malaria, What are two other things you absolutely must rule out, like right now before you even lock in on antimalarials? Go.
Give you a second. Did you get bacterial infection, especially meningitis and hypoglycemia? Those are killer. You can't miss.
Exactly. And that brings up another tip. Any unconscious patient where you suspect severe malaria, you really need a lumbar puncture, an LP, to rule out bacterial meningitis. Assuming, of course, there are no contraindications like focal neurosigns or they're too unstable for the procedure.
Yeah, missing meningitis co-infection. That's definitely M&M conference territory. You don't want that.
Definitely not. So if you can't remember everything from this first segment, remember this. Severe malaria means specific organ failure or a super high parasite load. Use that sharp CHAP framework for quick assessment. It can literally save a life.
Okay. Segment two, Wardwin's time to talk about actually fighting this parasite and managing the complications. So remember that patient I mentioned, the one whose GCS was dropping? My gut screamed seizure, maybe a bleed, but nope. It was profound hypoglycemia.
Sneaky, right,
and easily fixed, if you think of it. So let's get into those crucial interventions you need ready.
Yeah, the urgency is real. Patients can die within hours. So prompt IV treatment is non-negotiable. And you got to track that parasite count closely.
Okay.
Now, for the main drugs, the heavy hitters for parenteral treatment, there are basically two groups. You've got the artemisinins or tesinit, artemether, and then the older cinchona alkaloids, quinine, quinidine.
So how do we remember those?
Let's call them artists. Q, art for the artemisinins, and Q for quiniquinidine. Artists Q.
Artists Q. Okay, I like that. So which ones do we use?
All right, this is core knowledge. Parenteral artesanate, IV or IM, is the clear first choice. For everyone, adults, kids, even tiny infants, pregnant patients in any trimester, breastfeeding moms, why? It works incredibly fast, and studies show it leads to lower mortality compared to quinine. It's a game changer.
Definitely. But what if you're out in a rural clinic, no immediate IV access?
Great question. Pre-referral treatment is vital there. Ideally, a single shot of IM artesanate. The dose varies by weight. Kids under 20 kilos get 3 milliGV kilos. Bigger kids and adults get 2.4 milliGV kilos.
Okay, what if you don't even have IM artesanate?
Yeah. Then you look at alternatives. If the patient is 6 years or older, IM artemether is next best. Loading dose 3.2 milliGV kilograms. If that's not available, then IM quinine. That's a loading dose of 20 milliGV kilograms, but you split it 10 milliGV kilograms into each thigh.
Got it. What about younger kids under 6?
For them, if IM artesanate isn't an option, rectal artesanate at 10 milliGV kilogram is the go-to. It's actually been shown to cut mortality significantly in that specific age group.
But only under 6, right?
Exactly. Crucial point. Rectal artesanate is not recommended for older kids or adults. Studies actually linked it to increased deaths in those groups. So only for the little ones under 6.
Okay, good distinction. Here's war tip number 3. Let's say you're in the U.S. and parenteral artesanate isn't immediately on hand, which can happen. What do?
You bridge. Use oral artemether lumefantrine as a temporary measure until you can get the IV artesanate. Outside the U.S., if IV artesanate is delayed, you'd use IM artemether or IM quinine as the bridge. The key is starting some effective antimalarial immediately.
Right. Don't just wait. Now, side effects. What do we watch for with artesanate?
The big one is delayed hemolytic anemia. It doesn't happen right away. Usually kicks in maybe 8 to 32 days after finishing treatment. The hemoglobin can drop quite a bit. Average nadir is around 6.2.
So what does that mean for follow-up?
It means you must monitor hemoglobin. Check it at day 7, day 14, and day 30 after they finish artesanator. The thinking is that artesanate clears the parasites but leaves the red cells kind of damaged, so they break down later.
Okay, crucial follow-up point. What about quinine from the artist's Q mnemonic?
Quinine's trickier. Big concern is QTC prolongation on the ECG. So you need cardiac monitoring during the infusion. If the QTC stretches out more than 50% from baseline, you stop the infusion.
Safety first. Anything else?
Yes, hypoglycemia. Quinine can cause hyperinsulinemic hypoglycemia. So again, very close glucose monitoring is essential.
So let's recap the drugs. Thinking artists, Q artemisinins, specifically artesanate, are definitely the star players. But quinine still has a role if artesanate isn't available or maybe in specific resistance situations. Just got to be super careful with monitoring QTC and glucose.
Precisely. Now let's circle back to hypoglycemia. It's not just a side effect of quinine. It's a common feature of severe malaria itself, a real silent killer. You have to suspect it in any patient who's comatose or suddenly gets worse.
And the thresholds for treatment, you need these numbers cold. Under 5 years old. Treat if glucose is less than 3 millimoles per liter. That's about 54 milligrams per deciliter. 5 years and older, including adults, the threshold is lower. Less than 2.2 millimoles per liter or 40 milligrams per deciliter.
And the immediate fix, an IV bolus of dextrose.
0.25 grams per kilogram. Usually that works out to 2.5 millimoles per kilo of D10, 10% dextrose solution. Then you recheck the glucose every 15 minutes. What about maintenance fluids?
They need to have dextrose in them, at least 5%. If the hypoglycemia keeps coming back, you'll likely need to run 10% dextrose. Quick tip, if you only have D5, you can make D10. Pull 100 millimoles out of a 1 liter bag of D5 and replace it with 100 millimoles of D50. Quick bedside mix.
Handy trick. Word tip number 4, keep checking that glucose for at least 24 hours, even if it was normal initially. Hypoglycemia can sneak up on you or come back. If it ever drops below 3.0, you extend that monitoring for another 48 hours.
Good advice. Then there are seizures, super common, especially in kids. Maybe up to 70% have them. And watch out for subclinical seizures too, maybe 15-20% of cases.
So how do we treat seizures when they happen? Dosages here are key.
First line is benzodiazepines. Diazepam, 0.4 millibill cama, IV or rectal, or lorazepam, 0.1 millibill cama, IV or IO. You can repeat the dose once if needed.
Okay, diazepam or lorazepam, but what's the big caution?
Do not combine them. Don't give diazepam, then lorazepam, or vice versa. The risk of respiratory depression goes way up. Pick one, repeat if needed, but don't stack different benzos.
Got it. And here's ward tip number 5. Do not routinely give seizure meds prophylactically if the patient hasn't actually seized. Studies showed it might actually increase mortality, so treat active seizures, but don't give meds just in case.
Right, so pulling this segment together, if you only remember one thing, remember this. Parenteral artesunate, artist's cue, is your go-to drug, but watch for that delayed anemia. And don't forget the twin threats, hypoglycemia and seizures. Treat low sugar aggressively with dextrose, use benzos for seizures, and always keep that sharp CHAP framework in mind because these complications can mask themselves within those criteria.
Okay, segment 3, case clash time to put the pieces together and handle those curveballs. You know, I had this one malaria case, seemed straightforward, but the patient just wasn't turning the corner like they should have. Mm-hmm. Totally threw me for a loop, and it hammered home a lesson. The obvious diagnosis isn't always the only diagnosis. You got to learn to sniff out those hidden problems, especially co-infections.
That's a perfect lead-in. Concomitant bacteremia, bacteria in the bloodstream alongside the malaria, is surprisingly common, even if the patient doesn't look classically septic.
So what's the move?
You absolutely need blood cultures on everyone with severe malaria. And you should start empiric broad-spectrum antibiotics. Something like cetriaxone is a good choice because it covers common culprits like gram-negatives, including salmonella. Keep the antibiotics going until you have 48, maybe 72 hours of negative cultures to definitively rule out bacterial infection.
Don't skip the antibiotics, got it. What about special groups, like pregnant patients?
Yeah, pregnancy is high risk. Women, especially in the second and third trimesters, are more likely to get severe P. falciparum malaria,
yeah.
And they tend to have higher rates of hypoglycemia and pulmonary edema specifically.
So, treatment, still artesunate.
Yes. Parenteral artesunate is the treatment of choice in all trimesters. It's safer for both mom and baby. If you absolutely can't get artesunate, artemether is preferred over quinine, mainly because quinine really increases that risk of recurrent hypoglycemia in pregnancy.
Okay, artesunate is key in pregnancy. Now, let's talk cerebral malaria, that coma definition. Blantyre score 2 or less, P. falciparum, no other cause for coma, but how do you really know it's cerebral malaria?
This is fascinating. The single most reliable clinical sign is malarial retinopathy. You need someone skilled to look, ideally with indirect ophthalmoscopy, but the findings are specific. Things like white-centered hemorrhages, changes in the retinal blood vessels, maybe patches of retinal whitening.
And why is that so important?
Because if that specific retinopathy is absent, even if the patient has malaria parasites and is comatose, you need to strongly suspect and aggressively look for other causes of the coma, like meningitis, encephalitis, metabolic problems. The lack of retinopathy is a major clue that something else might be going on.
Wow. Okay, so the eye findings are really critical. All right, pause and think prompt 2. Quick scenario. Comatose kid, suspected severe malaria. For some reason, you cannot do an LP. What empiric treatment besides the antimalarial must ye start immediately? And why are those blood cultures still so vital?
You got it. You must start empiric antibiotics to cover bacterial meningitis. Because without the LP, you just can't rule it out. And missing it is catastrophic. And the blood cultures. Still essential to try and identify a bacterial pathogen if one is present, guiding your antibiotic choice later.
Perfect. Now let's talk fluids. This feels like a real tightrope walk.
It absolutely is. Their actual volume status can be really hard to judge. Are they dry? Are they overloaded? And adults especially are prone to fluid overload, which can tip them into pulmonary edema or worsen cerebral edema. The therapeutic window is narrow.
So what's the general approach?
Here's ward tip number 6. Generally, a restrictive fluid strategy seems better, aiming for maybe 2 to 3 mL per kilo per hour of crystalloid for the first 24 hours. Why? Because some signs we usually associate with being dry and malaria, like cool skin or deep breathing, might actually be due to problems in the microcirculation or severe anemia, not true volume depletion. Giving too much fluid can be really harmful.
Less is more, potentially. Okay, so wrapping up these complexities. Remember, sharp CHAP for diagnosis. Think artist's cue for treatment drugs. And always, always look for co-infections. Consider special groups like pregnant patients. And pay attention to nuanced signs like retinopathy. Okay, let's put it all into action. Interactive case study. The ICU challenge. Picture this. 7-year-old boy comes in from a malaria area. He's got altered mental status, clearly weak prostration, and he's taking these deep, labored breaths. Point of care glucose, 35. Lactate, 6.
Okay, so based on our mnemonic, sharp CHAP, what are two immediate features of severe malaria screaming out at you from that description?
You've got the impaired consciousness, maybe the prostration, definitely hypoglycemia, yeah. And that high lactate points towards acidosis. Boom, severe malaria criteria met. Okay, you've given the IV dextrose bolus for the sugar. What is your absolute next therapeutic step for the malaria? And what kind of drug, artist cue, are you grabbing?
Got to be parenteral artesunate. That's your immediate anti-malarial and artemisinin derivative.
Exactly. Okay, curveball time. It's 48 hours later. He's getting artesunate, but his coma score is worsening. And you notice some subtle nystagmus, maybe some irregular breathing. What's going through your head now?
Okay, alarm bells. Worsening coma despite treatment. You got to think. Is he seizing again? Maybe subclinically. Does his glucose drop again? Is his anemia getting worse?
Yeah.
And crucially, can we assess for malarial retinopathy? That would help confirm if this is truly worsening cerebral malaria or if we need to double down on looking for other causes. You basically run through sharp CHAP again in your head.
Good systematic approach. Branching scenario 2. What if you were in that remote clinic setting? No IV or artesunate. You do have IM artemether and rectal artesunate. He's 7 years old. What do you use?
He's 7. So IM artemether. Rectal artesunate is only for kids under 6.
Perfect recall. Branching scenario 3. His lab results come back. Hemoglobin is 4.8 GDL. What are your thoughts on transfusion, especially in an endemic area?
Okay, HB of 4.8 is definitely severe anemia, A in sharp CHAP. Transfusion is strongly considered. Guidelines vary slightly, but generally, HB less than 5 in high transmission areas warrants transfusion. Some protocols use HB less than 4 or signs of complicated anemia like respiratory distress. If you transfuse, typically it's whole blood, maybe 20 mmHg if they have a fever, 30 mmHg if they don't.
Great. Now, just take a second. Maybe pause the audio if you need to. Think through your reasoning for each step in that case. How did you prioritize? That rapid thinking is what makes the difference.
And if you take away only one thing from this whole complex segment, remember this. Severe malaria is a multi-system killer. Co-infections are common. Vulnerable groups need special care. And even tiny clinical changes like that subtle nystagmus demand your full attention and quick reassessment.
All right, team, listen up. Memory blast time. Let's lock this stuff in. Severe malaria definition. Use sharp CHAP. Yeah. Know it cold.
First line drug. Parenteral artesunate. Remember, artist's cue.
Post artesunate. Watch for delayed anemia. Check HB at 7, 14, 30 days.
Hypoglycemia. Know the thresholds. Hit it hard with dextrose. Keep monitoring.
Seizures, benzos first. Diazepam or lorazepam. No routine prophylaxis.
Think infection. Empiric antibiotics for bacteremia are essential. Get those cultures.
Pregnant. Artesunate preferred. Watch that glucose closely.
Coma. Look for malarial retinopathy. Key clue for true cerebral malaria.
Fluids. Be cautious. Restrictive approach is generally better. Avoid overload.
Okay, you've taken in a massive amount of info. You are seriously better prepared now to handle one of the toughest things we see on the wards. This isn't just about passing tests. It's about saving lives.
Absolutely. So take one thing you learned today, maybe just the sharp CHAP letters, and use it on the wards this week. Quiz yourself on Artist's Cue tonight. And hey, we actually want to hear from you. Share your own stories, the clutch saves, the near misses managing severe malaria. Find us. DM us at 88diagnoses. That's D-I-A-G-N-O-S-E-S, plural. Let's connect.
And here's something to think about later. That delayed anemia after artesunate. If it happens because the red cells aren't immediately destroyed but just live shorter lives, what does that imply about the longer-term effects of malaria on blood health, even after the parasites are cleared? Kind of makes you wonder, doesn't it? Something to chew on?